wanted to give a brief overview of some of the issues that are associated with closing and reclaiming a phosphogypsum stack. And I guess the first question is, what is phosphogypsum? A lot of people don't know unless you're intimately associated with the fertilizer industry or you live close to one of these things, but when you make phosphate fertilizer, you generate gypsum. And the basic reaction is that you take apatite rock, usually a fluorocalcium apatite, and you put it in an attack tank and you add concentrated sulfuric acid and a bit of water, and you get phosphoric acid as a reaction product, and that goes off to be ammoniated and turned into monoammonium phosphate, and you get gypsum and a little bit of hydrofluoric acid. Because of the stoichiometry of that reaction, you get about 5 tons of gypsum for every ton of fertilizer that you make. So there's huge piles of gypsum, byproduct gypsum, stacked up anywhere that phosphate fertilizer is produced. In North America, we just stack it up. A lot of countries in the world that are close to an ocean, they will dump it in the ocean or dump it into a river or put it somewhere else, but it's kind of frowned upon in North America, so we pile it. And in Canada, it's estimated we've got greater than 100 million tons of gypsum, and in the U.S., probably more than 8 billion tons. And a lot of that is localized in Florida and Central Florida and Phosphate Alley. Some of the properties that might be important for reclamation is that it's a very uniform size because it was generated through an industrial process. So most gypsum is fairly standard between 45 and 60 microns in particle size. It's damp. The moisture content's usually between 10 and 20%. It's always acidic. And depending on how fresh it is, it can be anywhere from pH 1 if it's just been generated from the phosphate fertilizer process, and the pH slowly goes up through time as the sulfuric and phosphoric and hydrofluoric runs out of it and it's leached through by rainwater. So it will gradually come up to an equilibrium with rainwater at about pH 5.5 or so. There might be some traces of bits of apatite or other rocks that have gone through the digestion process and not been dissolved. And any trace components that were in the apatite rock to begin with are either going to be in the gypsum or they're going to go into the fertilizer. And depending on the element, they tend to partition a little bit differently. Cadmium tends to go with the phosphate fertilizer. If there's selenium in the rock, it tends to go into the gypsum. Generally, the trace metals are pretty low, but some rocks have more stuff in them than others. So a sedimentary apatite from Idaho will have more selenium and cadmium in it than an igneous rock from northern Ontario, for example. Fluoride's always high, usually between 8 and 10,000 parts per million. And there's also small amounts of radium in all phosphogypsums because the radium tends to substitute for calcium in the apatite structure, and then it travels with the gypsum. So phosphogypsum's a norm material, naturally occurring radioactive material. It's low, and it's a diffuse source, but it does have radium in it. And just as an aside, and I won't be getting into possible reuse opportunities for this here, but it's so low that in Canada we have used it for a number of agricultural and environmental applications because any kind of risk assessment shows that there is no risk above background for any application like that. So we only have one active gyp stack in Canada, and that's at Redwater, which is about an hour northeast of Edmonton. It's a big one. We started production there in the late 1960s, and our estimated size at closure is about 720 acres. It's going to be over a section and a half of land, and it's going to be at least 125 feet high. Here's an aerial shot from a few years ago, and it's kind of hard to get the perspective from the air, but all that white and water that you see covers about 1 square mile. And it's about 37, 38 million metric tons of gypsum. The water there is from the process. After the rock is digested, the gypsum is filtered out, and then water's added back to it again, and it's sluiced up to the top. The gypsum settles out. The water is recycled into the process once again, so it's a closed-loop system. And we ran out of room because it's like a pyramid. As we go up, we lose the surface area. So we have just expanded to the north, and we're moving on to the next half section of land. Just another shot from the top. There's always heavy equipment up there, digging and dredging and drying it out so the gypsum can be compacted and used for construction dikes and berms. And just a hand view in some of my... I often describe it to people as having kind of the look and feel of brown sugar because it's damp. It's kind of a light brown color, and it's not dusty. It's got that kind of damp, sugarish look. So it's quite nice to handle from a farmer's perspective. Now, they're big, but the idea behind closing a gyp stack or reclaiming it is basically to smooth over the top, put some soil on it, and vegetate it. So you would have a really big grassy mountain. Because once the acid water is leached out and rainwater percolates through, what you're left with is gypsum. And there's nothing inherently toxic about it. And there's been some previous work by Mike Rutherford and other people that have shown that all the leachates are essentially environmentally benign. In the first little while, there might be a little bit of elevated fluoride, and after that, there's a little hazard. In Florida, where most of the gyp stacks in North America are, they have a lot of rain. They put a synthetic liner on the top, and then they put 2 feet of topsoil and some grass seed. On the sides of the gyp stack, they'll put a little bit of soil or some dolomitic limestone or something to just kind of break up the crust and add a little bit of, increase the pH slightly. They have, like I say, they have a lot of rain, they have hurricanes. In Alberta, it's a semi-arid environment. We get probably 17 or 18 inches of rain a year, and our evapotranspiration is higher than our precipitation. But we don't have a lot of gypsum stacks, and we don't have one that's formally closed, and the regulatory bodies don't quite know what to do with them. So they consider them a landfill, and they said, if you close your gyp stack, we want you to put 1 meter of soil cover over the whole thing, over 720 acres of gypsum that is environmentally benign, according to previous work. Now, we only have 8 or 10 inches of soil that is stockpiled right now, so to put a meter over the whole thing, we would end up stripping the neighboring countryside. I did a back-of-the-envelope calculation, but I think it was like 162 acres we'd have to strip to a depth of 10 feet to put on top of the gypsum stack mountain. So you'd be scalping all the adjoining farmland to put it on top of one thing. So, besides saving a lot of money, to prove that less than 1 meter is adequate for closure and protecting the environment. It's also probably very environmentally protective. You don't have all the dump trucks running day after day, and you're not stripping the farmland. We hadn't done a lot of reclamation research because we aren't planning on closing this plant for another 20 or 25 years, but thought it wise to better get going on it now. In the early 2000s, first we did an experiment at Redwater, which is the active stack, just to look at the minimum amount of soil that we needed to grow grass. So we installed some runoff diversion things so we didn't have acidic process water wiping out our grasses, and we used whatever kind of soil amendments we could find. We had some raw manure, we had some topsoil, and compost, we rototilled it in, and then we seeded a variety of different grass treatments. And just to give you a picture, we're working on a ledge, probably about 80 feet up from the ground, a little research tractor, and rototilling it in, different treatments, all replicated. And one of the treatments, a month after seeding, and you can see the gyps pretty much bare. I can't see any soil in there. But we found even a small amount kind of adds some exchange capacity and breaks up the crust. A couple months later, another vegetation treatment. And it just kind of kept growing and growing and growing. So years later, we have a lush meadow that has to be mown probably twice a year. So that's all good and fine. We don't have to add very much soil to grow grass. We know that. And it didn't matter what kind of grass. We had clover, we had wildflowers, everything just grew wonderfully well. And even in areas where there was nothing seeded, but the acidic process water wasn't running through the gypsum anymore, we had poplar trees and fireweed and everything just growing in itself. So over time, I think the gyp stack would just reclaim itself without any help. But the important thing here is, okay, we can grow grass, but is that environmentally protective? Is the infiltration of the water, is that going to be a problem? Is it going to have to be treated forevermore? Is the runoff water clean? Can it be discharged? And a lot of other questions that have to be proved to regulatory agencies about radiation and trace element uptake and what have you. Is also be ideal to be practical and economical. So what we did is we partnered with the University of Alberta for a 5-year research study. We moved all of the work to an inactive gyp stack that was probably a 20-minute drive away, and it's been inactive for about 20 years, and we established a big experiment with 6 different soil depths and seeded it to 5 different vegetation treatments. So just to give you an idea, there's a plot map, and it's all replicated and randomized and seeded. And it covers a pretty big area. We were hauling soil for quite some time. And you don't really get an appreciation for how deep 36 inches of soil is until you watch the number of trucks that have been brought in and moved it around, and a little seed drill plotting it in. So 2 months after seeding, grass is slowly starting to come up. The soil came from an alfalfa pasture, so we have some alfalfa in there as well as everything else. And then just before the snow fell, which was Sunday, it more or less looked like that. So we look forward to next year. The vegetation will be well established, and we can install lysimeters and look at if water is getting past the root zone and the quality of that water and trace element uptake. So we can categorically say that a certain depth of soil is environmentally protective, it's sustainable, and all the other questions that have to be answered before we walk away from this. So just in summary then, I guess it's easy to grow grass on gypsum. And if you've been through Alberta or flown over, I mean, it's huge, it's white, it's scary looking. But once you stop making fertilizer, grass, trees, everything will grow on it. You have to get the acidic process water out, and then it's just a sparingly soluble salt. So we need to continue with the ongoing research to prove to the government and regulatory agencies that the soil depth that we will choose will fully protect the environment, and it's good for the community. And this is one of those graduate student projects that is going to be worth millions of dollars, because the recommendations that are collected by the grad students on this we will use and present those to the regulators and say, look, this is what they proved in 5 years and this is what they recommend. So it's what we've got, because to compare Florida to Alberta, it doesn't work. So thank you. I could say the buck stops here, but that's a female deer. So.
No steps here.
Yeah.
Any questions?
I have one. When you did 36 inches of soil, I don't understand. Did you dig it down and then put in your, or did you just put it over the top and now you got 36 inches?
Yes. Yes.
So how did you keep that soil from running into the ones where you didn't have, where you had 0 or 1 inch or 2 inches?
We have large alleyways between the plots, and we made the plots big enough to account for edge effects, but what they are is a big 1 meter pile like this, and then we will take the majority of our measurements in the middle. Due to cost constraints, we could not excavate out and have it so it was all the same height. It was cost prohibitive, and as it was, this experiment cost about $400,000 to set up.
I had a similar question. It seemed like there was a lot of gypsum mixed in at the top.
Yeah.
Is that just tracked in? Or?
The Fort Saskatchewan, the soil depth experiments, it wasn't rototilled in. The first time we did it, we actually did mix it, just to see, and we found that even a little bit of soil broke up that crust and added some nitrogen fertility and some exchange.
But even in that last picture that you showed, there was quite a bit of white tracking on the surface.
Yeah. When you're driving the drill up and you're, And so there's a lot of talks here about gypsum soils, and they're really relevant because when you're trying to measure things here, you have part soil and part gypsum, and it's tricky trying to get results. So.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.